and welcome to the very first in a new podcast, The First Incision by CMF, where we discuss topics at the interface of faith and medicine that affect our Christian lives in today's world. I'm your host, Dr. James Howitt, and I've got here with me today Dr. James May. James, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
So James is a London-based GP who also works for Healthwatch, an evidence-based medicine charity, and he's coming today to talk to us about the very interesting topic of mindfulness. Right, so James, we're just going to jump straight into things. Tell us practically, first of all, what is mindfulness as a psychological technique? And also, what's its goal? What are people looking for when they're using it?
Yeah, thank you. So mindfulness, as far as I understand it, is originally a Buddhist technique that was then developed into a psychological technique, which grew a whole range of different applications, including clinical treatments for anxiety and depression, but for all sorts of things. And really, when you go to the bookshops, you can see mindfulness being applied across all sorts of parts of life, gardening or whatever you like.
Yeah, it seems to be everywhere at the moment, isn't it?
That's right, yes. And it aims to focus our minds on our sensations and our experiences in a detached way so that we're not committed to them and upset by them particularly, but just observe them and see them as transient things passing in front of us. And alongside this, there's an attitude of non-judgmental self-acceptance and self-compassion.
Okay.
These are important words. That sees suffering as a transient thing that passes in front of us, and even that our desires are in fact illusions, and that we just come to see them as things that pass. It's particularly become an issue today because of the distractions, I think, of the modern world. And it aims positively at human flourishing and trying to make us better, happier people. And it is quite a complex thing, I think, and it takes quite a while to get your head around what is going on with mindfulness. But it does, I have found in thinking about it, that it's been a very useful way of reflecting on what it does mean to flourish as a human being and how we can help each other to do that.
Okay, so we've already identified that there seems to have been a real kind of spread of mindfulness. What is it you think's driven the increase of popularity in the last decade?
The last decade seems to have coincided quite specifically with the rise of smartphones and social media. And that the reason for that is very clear, is that we already in our modern lives are very busy. There's lots going on. Even though actually we've got in some ways more time than people might have had in the past, fridges and washing machines and other technology have meant that we've got a lot more free time. But our free time seems to be filled with things that distract our attention, whether it's advertisements or bills that we've got to pay or meetings we've got to do. We're all aware all the time that things pop into our minds of obligations and things that we worry about. And so mindfulness and social media and smartphones obviously feed into that. They distract us. They nudge us in certain directions the whole time, and we have them in our pockets, and our lives feel very distracted. And so mindfulness seems a very helpful way of retreating and finding a place where that doesn't happen, and even managing to sort of control these distracting thoughts by perhaps observing them in this sort of transient way. There's also another motivation, I think, recently, which is a broader theme in society, which is the therapeutic society, where we no longer have the friends and the community around us, particularly in big cities, where we can sort of bounce ideas off people for the everyday problems in life. And we increasingly turn to sort of therapeutic options and get professionals involved or techniques to help us get through life. And I think there is an element of the therapeutic that comes in with mindfulness as well, which makes it popular today.
Okay. So there's almost some kind of maybe some kind of contrast between the social isolation and yet increased connectivity that we have with smartphones, but kind of the devolution of family.
Yes, there's all sorts of paradoxes that run all the way through our current culture and mindfulness, that we are connected, but we're not necessarily relating to people. And so mindfulness is taking us a step back from that.
Interesting. So how did the practice of mindfulness start? Where did it all come from?
As far as I understand, it started with Buddha, with what was called Vipassana meditation or insight meditation, where we become aware of ultimate reality and its transience by performing this meditation and the oneness ultimately of reality. In the 1960s, in the sort of countercultural hippie movement in California in particular, there was an interest in Eastern religions and people started practicing mindfulness. And I don't know exactly when that happened, but there are a number of movements that happened at the time which seemed to feed into the sort of ideas that mindfulness has become part of. So one was the human potential movement, in which we are encouraged to have unconditional positive self-regard. And Carl Rogers, the psychologist, was the man behind that. Then there was the self-esteem movement, which has been very influential in the way that we think today, by a guy called Nathaniel Brandon.
Okay.
And interestingly, his first pillar of self-esteem was mindfulness. And this developed over time and was used by Jon Kabat-Zinn, who was influenced by Buddhist teachers, who in 1979 developed what was called mindfulness-based stress reduction, or MBSR, are the initials that you sometimes see around the place. And this was a sort of step from the more religious or cultural practice of mindfulness to it being a more scientific and clinically established technique. And then more recently, Professor Mark Williams, who's a psychologist and now retired from the Oxford Mindfulness Centre, or he founded the Oxford Mindfulness Centre, has been publishing large numbers of articles and books on the subject of mindfulness. And I think that he coincides with the much more recent sort of popularity of mindfulness.
So what does the evidence for mindfulness show us with these books, these publications? What are we kind of learning from an evidence base about this?
Well, in recent years, we've moved from relatively few trials on the subject of mindfulness to currently now several thousand trials on mindfulness. But the problem is that mindfulness is a complex intervention, and that makes gathering evidence very difficult. It's very difficult to know what are the defining features of mindfulness which you're studying and how you know which of those might be the effective ones. And really, trials should try and figure out which are the variables and how you are knowing which one is the active component. And that's difficult. A simple summary of the evidence would be to say that the majority of studies, because of these problems, are very poor in quality, and that the better studies have the worse results in terms of the effectiveness of mindfulness. Possibly some of the benefits, there's some evidence of benefit for recurrent depression, but it's always unclear if it's mindfulness or some other factor that's the main reason for that. And Mark, I had a conversation on the phone with Mark Williams, and he himself said that the evidence for mindfulness is, in his word, overblown.
Right. Yes, because presumably you can't blind these kind of studies particularly, or there must be quite a lot of challenges that come across with doing any kind of evidence base
exactly.
In this kind of study.
Yeah.
So is it possible to pin down which specific components of mindfulness are effective?
Well, I think it's very difficult. So, for example, is it the focused attention on individual sensations that is the effective component of mindfulness? And if so, then would listening to music count, and would that have the same result? Or is it the detached attitude or the sort of stoical indifference to what our emotions are that's the effective component, or the non-judgmental, self-accepting and self-compassionate stance, or the insight that reality is an illusion? All these things are mindfulness together, but they've all got quite different effects on who we are as people. Or is it just taking time out to sit quietly? Or is it a combination of all of them? I don't know. And I haven't seen studies effectively untangle those things. And many studies conclude we cannot be sure that it is the specific components of mindfulness that have had this effect. So And as you point out, there's an additional problem of blinding these trials. It's very difficult to have a control group, since anyone who is in one arm of it will know whether or not they are doing mindfulness. And this makes it very difficult to untangle whether or not it is the intervention that's having an effect or some other thing.
So with all these studies, are there any suggestions of any negative consequences for mindfulness?
Well, there have actually, unfortunately, been very few studies on the negative consequences for mindfulness. And that's unfortunate, and possibly itself tells a story about the enthusiasm to show that it's working rather than the more balanced approach where we're looking to check both positive and negative effects. There has been a large study in America that talks about that looks at how criminals had their thinking changed by mindfulness. And whilst I understand that there have been several studies on criminals, this particular study showed that their cognitions, their thinking about criminal behavior, seemed to be made worse by the practice of mindfulness. And it's been speculated that the sort of the idea of self-acceptance and the coming to terms with who you are that mindfulness sometimes encourages has been behind that. There have also been case reports of suicide and of psychotic episodes that have been made worse by mindfulness and other forms of meditation. Which I think emphasizes that actually we do need to separate out the different elements of mindfulness, because it may be that the self-compassionate element is reassuring, or that the focus on particular sensations is calming. But it may be that the sense that the insight that reality isn't really there and is an illusion is disturbing and upsetting. Or the other way around, and we just don't know. But it is important to figure those things out.
So it's very obvious, really, that our current culture is in a place of expressive individualism. We've already talked about social media eruptions as well. How do these elements of society fit in with our current views of mindfulness?
Well, I sometimes think that we still live in the 1960s. At least we've still got the same elements which date back to the 1960s of consumerism, which developed in the 1960s, the interest in Eastern religions, which became much stronger in the 1960s, and the development of the self-esteem movement and all these self movements and the therapeutic society. We talk about the need to find ourselves. We talk about the need to be true to ourselves. Star Wars, of course, famously talks about the force being strong within us. And we talk about finding our own meanings and creating our identities and expressing who we are. Consumerism helps us to do this because we buy stuff which creates our lifestyle, and that may be holidays and travel to exotic locations to then take selfie photos of ourselves. And so social media also feeds into this, where we curate our experiences and present who we want to express ourselves to be to our friends and our family and people around us and to people we don't know. These are all elements which feed into each other quite strongly. Paradoxically, Buddhism is actually quite self-negating and sees the self as an illusion which we can't grasp onto and hold onto too tightly. Okay. Because it vanishes. And I've been puzzling over this a little bit, because I think mindfulness doesn't seem to quite do that. And I wonder if it's because of the way it's been imported into the West and into our cultural context, which is much more self-orientated. And so mindfulness talks about self-acceptance and self-compassion, which again are both from a Buddhist origin, but they have slightly subtly different meanings when they're given a Western translation. So the acceptance in Buddhism is to accept that we're not really there, maybe.
Okay.
That we're just illusions, whereas the acceptance in the Western context might even be a reaction against Christian guilt, that we've got to learn to come to terms with our guilt. So it has a different feeling in that sense. I think there's also, because of the secular and even atheist culture that we have around us, there's a need to create from nothing, because life ultimately has no meaning. We need to create our meanings, and there isn't a foundation for the meaning. And so maybe there is a kind of symbiosis between the Buddhist idea that the reality is that life, that ourselves aren't real, and the atheist thing, which would agree with that on many levels, and our need, therefore, to create ourselves.
Okay, I mean, that's all very good, and it's good we can sit here and talk about the evidence. But what would you say to people who argue, well, if it works for me, then if I feel better, why should I really worry about what the evidence says?
Well, I have a lot of sympathy for that on one level, because the evidence is very difficult to find, and we don't stop doing things just because we don't have definitive scientific evidence for something. And general practice and primary care is full of common sense advice that we give to people that, strictly speaking, has no evidence base. And maybe we just advise people according to things that might seem helpful, and they don't necessarily take them up, and we don't need to sort of recommend that this will definitely work for you, and that's anyways a bit of a myth in medicine, I think, that we can sort of have magic bullets to solve life's problems. So that's on the one hand. On the other hand, though, to say it works for me raises the question of what has worked for you. A parallel example might be, for example, the faddish diets that are around us. Now, it may be that you have read about a diet recently that you thought, that sounds interesting, and you try it and you manage to lose weight. And I think it's perfectly reasonable to say that it worked for me, because you've objectively lost weight.
Yes, you've achieved what you were aiming to do, yeah.
So it's difficult to argue against, but then you'd have to raise the question of, well, what is it that worked? Was it this diet, or could any diet have worked for you? Or could it just have been the enthusiasm to lose weight which drove you to the diet book, which made you then lose weight? You maybe started eating less, whether or not you were on a particular diet or doing exercise. And so I think the same question would apply to the mindfulness. Is it the mindfulness itself that's made you feel better, or is it something else? So I think an additional problem, though, is that it's very difficult for us to work out what is best for us. We're conflicted very often in our motivations. And the example of the study for the criminals and their criminal cognitions, I think, demonstrates this. They may genuinely feel better for having their guilt relieved and thinking that they can just accept themselves and accept their criminal cognitions, and they think it's fine to be a bad person. That might seem extreme, but there's also our tendency towards being self-orientated. And if mindfulness encourages us just to think about ourselves and our own feelings, then that might also be negative in the long run. And I'm just cautious also about the idea of it worked for me. When we live in a very me-centered world, it may not make us better people just because we feel better.
So are there any differences between mindfulness and maybe more biblical stillness or biblical meditation that we see?
I think that mindfulness potentially has a lot in common with biblical meditation. Clearly the Bible and the Psalms in particular do exhort us to meditate a lot, and humanly speaking, we need space and time and solitude to do that, and Jesus himself withdraws to solitary places a lot of the time in order to be able to pray. So this is mandated biblically, and we should do that. The subtleties of what that means and how we apply that in our lives, I think, are worth exploring a bit, however. It's interesting, for example, that the word withdraw, which is used in the Gospels when talking about Jesus withdrawing, is often the type of withdraw to kind of, in a battle, to strategically reframe yourself before re-entering the battle. It gives it a slightly different feel to think of it like that. Another example is the psalmist saying, "Be still and know that I am God." And we might have sometimes a slightly sentimental view of what that means. And a lot of Christian books have pictures of sunsets and mountains on them, which actually, interestingly, is a little bit like the mindfulness books, which have pictures of often beautiful women sitting by calm lakes with rocks and things.
Okay.
But this sort of calm beauty, which we see around us, we transpose onto our sort of biblical interpretation, and it may not necessarily be the way that the Bible meant it. So the biblical narrative moves us actually from a garden to a city, and it's about people and being together in multitudes and sometimes noisy multitudes. And silence sometimes in the Bible is seen as a bad thing. In fact, often enemies, for example, are silenced. And the psalmist says, "God, do not be silent." We need God speaking into our lives. So the "be still" actually in the psalm is in also in a battle context. And Jesus himself, he says to the storm, "Be still," and to the demon-possessed man, "Be still." So I was trying to think of a picture that helps us think what might this look like for us. So it may be that we're in a shopping mall, buying lots of things, pursuing our materialist dreams, and God says to us, "Be still and know that I am God." Whereas we maybe prefer the view that is a little bit more like the mindfulness view, that it's us finding God in our tranquility, that there are sunsets and mirror-like lakes, rather than God finding us in storms and in our wild and distracted states. So I think this needs exploring in all sorts of ways, and I don't think we should make too many assumptions about it, and perhaps we need to think how much we've been influenced by a sort of Zen-like way of looking at the world.
So is there, do you think, a general tension then between the Christian faith and the practice of mindfulness?
Yes, I think there is a tension. There's always a tension with Christianity. Christianity never sees things the way the rest of the world does.
Probably just as well, otherwise we wouldn't have a podcast to record.
Exactly right. But there are many things in common with mindfulness, I'd say. I think the pursuit of human flourishing is something that Christians can share with mindfulness and Buddhism. And the need to deal with distractions and the need to face our suffering. All these are things that we can share, as well as, interestingly, the idea that life is transient and ephemeral. The psalmist says that all flesh is like grass. So there's a lot in common with mindfulness and Buddhism. But Buddhism does go further than that and says that all of reality is an illusion and nothing is solid. Whereas Christianity calls us back to us having a rock, and the person of Jesus is our rock and our cornerstone. He is a firm place we can stand, and our identity is not created out of nothingness. It's given to us by him, and we are his children, and that is our firm identity and place to stand. There's also a stoicism about mindfulness where we observe our sufferings and don't get engaged with them and just see them passing, which I think is at odds with a Christian worldview. And John Stott, in his book, The Cross of Christ, if I could just quote him, because I think he puts it better than I can. He says, "In the real world of pain, how could one worship a God who is immune to it? I've entered many Buddhist temples in different Asian countries and stood respectfully before the statue of the Buddha, his legs crossed, his arms folded, eyes closed, the ghost of a smile playing around his mouth, a remote look on his face, detached from the agonies of the world. But every time, after a while, I've had to turn away, and in my imagination, I have turned instead to that lonely, twisted, tortured figure on the cross. Nails through hands and feet, backs lacerated, limbs wrenched, brow bleeding from thorn pricks." So I think ultimately there is a big difference, and Christianity does have a lot more to offer, that both in our approach to suffering and our understanding of the nature of reality. And the incarnation itself is about God entering into this world. So God somehow enters into our transient world and lives a brief life here on earth some 2,000 years ago, and somehow redeems even the transients.
So is there an overall take-home message, do you think, from what you've shared with us today?
I think that the main take-home message is that we often want life to be simple, and we are often enthusiastic about new techniques and new things that might help us and solve our problems. But life in its reality is often much more complicated. I think cultural baggage that we bring to these things often dominates us subconsciously, so that we take it in directions that are perhaps less helpful. And there's a lot of questions about the evidence and what's actually working with mindfulness that I don't think have been satisfactorily answered yet.
So finally, where could people go if they've been listening, they're very interested, like, where can I go to get more information or to find other resources on this?
Well, it depends what you're looking to do. If you're looking to find out about mindfulness, then there's numerous books. Two that I've read. One is called Mindfulness in Plain English, which is quite good if you're wanting to understand a little bit more about a Buddhist understanding of what mindfulness is in particular. Another is called The Mindful Way Through Depression, which is by Jon Kabat-Zinn, who really founded the sort of clinical approach to mindfulness, and Mark Williams. But if you're trying to look at the more cultural background, I found a book called Selfie by Will Storr is very helpful in exploring, since the 1960s, the sort of the impact of the self-esteem movement in particular. But he takes looks at things more broadly than that still. Then there's a book by Shelley Turkle, who's a psychologist who writes a book called Reclaiming Conversation in the Digital Age. And she looks at the impact digital media have had on how we interact with each other, which I think is part of what's going on with the popularity of mindfulness, and is worth looking at. And a Christian book, which I found helpful, which is quite short and easy to access, is called The Techwise Family. I don't think you have to have your own family to learn from this book, and it has a biblical approach to technology, which you may not agree with everything it says, but I think it's quite helpful.
Amazing. James, you've given us so much to think on, so much to go away and ponder. Thank you so much for coming on the show. I'm really, really grateful. And thank you to everyone for listening. I hope you've enjoyed yourselves, and we'll be with you again in 2 weeks' time. Thanks, and God bless.